Hello, my name is Connor.
And I'm Jason.
And you are listening to the Amaze and Perplex podcast.
We're excited to be with you. We're continuing in Luke 4 today, and we were in thinking about setting the context and what might Jesus and the people, what might they be expecting, because he does seem to be alone in the setting. So that's another dynamic. Even though he's had some interaction, I believe, with disciples, there's no sense of them being here. He's returned to his hometown. They're expecting amazing because they've heard about amazing, and he reads a from Isaiah, which we covered in our last episode, and they're amazed. I mean, they're amazed at his gracious words. He hasn't said much, but it's just amazing, and it's exciting because he claims, "I'm the Messiah you've been waiting for," in a way that they would understand. And I'm thinking as we function, I have a friend, actually you and I both, Connor, have a friend named John McCoy. And at John McCoy's graduation from high school, he had a friend who was a vow Victorian who spoke. And when he gets up there, he is so ready. You can tell he's just been saving up his ammo because basically he crushes the school. I mean, he crushes it. And at the end, and this is where I thought, man, he is really biting the hand that feeds here. I know he thinks he has nothing to lose, but he is just crushing it. And by crushing it, I don't mean good. I mean, he's criticizing it and slamming it.
Well, you know? for a neutral observer like you, it has to be good. But, you know.
It was a lot of fun.
Were you there?
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
So at the very end, he goes, he says, and I don't know exact words, but because I just have to tell this, that we're outside in a football stadium, you know, and we're sitting there on the, you know, and there in the middle, and we're on the bleachers. And at the very end, he goes, and for my final thought, and then over the loudspeaker, AC/DC's, "For those about to rock, we salute you." And they actually have pyrotechnics that fire off. And that's when it hit me. He is aided and abetted by adults here. Like, there are adults that approve this. And I'm like, who would do that? But it's the whole scene of, why would you save up all this criticism for the last, you know, the pinnacle of your experience? That, to me, if I am sitting there and I am waiting and I hear about this Jesus and I think, huh, that's weird. I didn't notice that before, unless he was doing a lot of miracles, which we have no sense that that was the case. And then he reads and he's gracious and I'm amazed. I knowing my personality, I'd be in the audience going, this is awesome. This is awesome, man. He came from our town, and look how good he is. And up to this point, we don't know of miracles that they had the you know, the water. We think the water to wine had already happened in another place. We don't know if that had covered, but he wasn't doing the healing yet that he eventually does. But still, the reputation was strong. He's our guy. He's our hometown boy. And I don't know. I just think that would be the setting of the people, the crowd.
Yeah. Well, and you know, even you saying that, I kind of gained some empathy maybe for, you know, these people that are about to chase the savior of the world out of their hometown. Because I think about like that story with John McCoy, John McCoy's graduation ceremony, which is just so funny. And I would have loved to be there. And if I'd been a student or a parent, it would just be fantastic. But I do think like there had to have been a mom there whose like kid just really worked their butt off, who like this was a massive deal, and then you have this punk kid who you know, who, and maybe they were completely valid criticisms. I don't know what he said, but you go like, oh, there was somebody in that crowd probably who was not even just like the, you know, the administration that he was going after, but like there was probably a parent in that crowd who was like deeply hurt or wounded by like the fact that this culmination of this thing that their kid worked for was not how it was supposed to go, and not what you were always told it was supposed to be, and maybe even you feel a little like it was belittled or is made less than. And I think, I don't know. I'll be interested to track through this if I feel that same way. But yeah, I just go wonder. I was like, maybe I need to have more empathy for these people.
Yeah, it does hit me. For the record, John was asked to say the prayer, and he did a great job. So he was not associated with this, despite the fact this was the friend. So we're going to pick up in the middle of verse, I think this is 22. Now we'll just start with the beginning of 22 and go through the end of that section. So it says there, all spoke well of him, spoke well of Jesus, and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips. Isn't this Joseph's son? They ask. Jesus said to them, surely you will quote this proverb to me, physician, heal yourself. And you will tell me, do here in your hometown what we have heard that you did in Capernaum. Truly I tell you, he continued, no prophet is accepted in his hometown. I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time, when the sky was shut for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine throughout the land, yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath, in the region of Sidon. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet, yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian. All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of the town, and took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built in order to throw him off the cliff. But he walked right through the crowd and went on his way. That's amazing.
Yeah,
that whole thing is just so bizarrely amazing. I'm sure I heard that growing up, but I think we should just tell that the superhero acts of Jesus in the Bible. That is amazing. But what amazes you about that when you hear that?
So I think the fact that this is something that his hometown needs to hear. Like, there's this deep truth that Jesus is trying to communicate about what the town Israel, what they've missed out upon, what they are not understanding about what God wants to be doing and what God is about here on earth. And it would be so easy for Jesus to stop at, and they were amazed. Like, it'd be so easy, like, oh, I've got them, right? Like, I've got them to the point. And yet it is so amazing to me, because it's so easy for me to feel so closely connected with Jesus when he says last week what we covered. It's so easy for me to connect with Jesus, but for the Jesus that can be confrontational, that can be like, no, that, like, there is something that is not right that needs to be said to you, and like doesn't couch his words in some sort of fear of physical repercussion for himself. I just find myself amazed that Jesus can walk that line so well, because I feel like for most of us, we tend to, and I fall much more on the passive side of things. You tend to see, like, either if you're a more passive person or more aggressive, or if, you know, you tend to see Jesus, you tend to like gravitate more closely towards the passive side of Jesus. And for me, that's usually where I tend to go. But to see Jesus being strong, be strong in this way, in this confrontational way, and not against the Pharisees or the Sadducees that had all the power, had all the, you know, to see him not shy away from this conflict, is incredibly challenging, but yet amazing to me.
I think that's a good point. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day, and they were like, and I know this has kind of become a trope among Christians of Jesus was only mad at the religious leaders. And I'm like, no. I mean, he was at times, but he loved the religious leaders deeply. You know, I think we make a mistake just to think he now puts on the, you know, the good guy hat and everybody else, all the Pharisees, the bad guy hat. You know, yeah. He shows great patience with these supposed, you know, bad guy religious leaders.
Sure. And even at the end, you know, the favorite parable, you know, the parable of the prodigal son, you get this yearning. We've talked about it before with the second son. You get this yearning that he's speaking directly to the religious leaders. Like, no, you can still be a part. You can still be here. And so, yeah, like the idea that it's a one-sided, like that Jesus came to earth to do battle with the religious leaders is just not reality.
That's exactly right. And this is a great example. And I just think, and this is the part, and maybe this would fall into what perplexes me, but I don't know how many of they are they. So at first it says, all spoke well of him and were amazed at his gracious words. But then they ask, and how are they asking? And if you don't have Jesus' response, I think you can leave that really up in the air. You have to assume what he's taken from this is, if you're the Messiah, how are you Joseph's son? You know? And then I'm like, oh, do they not know he was the illegitimate son of Joseph? Like I think James and Jude are Joseph's son. You know what I mean? So that's also an interesting, you know, thing about how did he present to his small town? Did they talk about Jesus being born by the Holy Spirit? Did they quiet that? It seems they quieted it, you know? So anyway, but I think from Jesus' perspective, this is like a choose your own adventure. If you didn't know this is what happened and you just froze there and you say, what is Jesus' next response? this could easily be perceived as a teachable moment, mm-hmm. like a gentle teachable moment.
Yeah, yeah.
Like he's like, yeah, I know exactly why you think that, because that's the impression we gave you. I do need you to know when I was born, Mary was still a virgin, and I was born by the Holy Spirit and the angel Gabriel. You know what I mean? This would be a great retelling of the nativity story. And yet he goes for the throat. I mean, he's like, it's funny too here in this, and maybe this is what amazes me. I'll borrow this. I'll say this is what amazes me because there's so much about this. But that idea of he jumps right to their racism, their nationalism, their belief that they're saved because they're children of Abraham. And this comes up later throughout the Gospels, but he's hitting this so directly. There's a ton of things he could have said here and not said the Gentiles are favored over the Jews, because that's what he's saying. He's saying that if you're not familiar with biblical history as a listener, this is why they're so angry, because these are oppressed people, and they've been oppressed before the Romans. It's like, hey, who's the next
who's
group?
Next, yeah,
who's next to oppress us? And their big thing was, we are children of Abraham. This is our promised land, and this thing. And Jesus basically says, God favored somebody else, you know, with the implication, God may be favoring somebody else right now. You're not special. And this is, I think, to the common Jew, this is all they had. Mm. You know, the Romans had stripped them, and the people before them had stripped them even more. But I mean, the Romans had stripped them of all their basic freedoms. They didn't have self-determination. This was still their claim. And here this Jesus is, and this explains why the turn. Because it's like, why such a visceral response, and why so violent? I mean, they're not allowed, under Jewish law, they're not allowed just to kill somebody because they said something you don't like. They had to be convinced this is straight up blasphemy, and that gives us the right to kill this guy, you know? And it's passion, so I'm not saying it's well reasoned. I'm simply saying what justifies this in their mind.
Yeah, well, and you've used this example before of like, what if somebody came into your church and, you know, were very compelling at first, but then was like, hey, everything you based all this on, you're wrong, completely wrong. In fact, the people across the street, let's think about like it to the modern American church. What like, it's hard because we don't have those same categories that they had back then. But if somebody came to church, no, it's really the Muslims that have it right. Actually, mm-hmm. really, they're the ones that, you know, God's maybe turning his favor on. You know, you'd be like, you know, I have faith in Memorial that they would handle that very well. But like for most people, like there would be if that kept happening, there'd be this like, no, like that's like, how dare you to one extent or the other? And if you knew that person beforehand and you thought that they were a part of your tribe, and now they're saying, you know, now they're distancing themselves from you, like, how dare you?
Yeah, exactly. And I think your response would be, this has to stop. Now, that's a reasonable. And I would respect that, you know. Yeah. Here it's like, hey, Jesus, I get it. There's something going on with you, but that has to stop. You can't be in our synagogue saying we're not a favored people. You just can't do that, you know. And they took that message
sure.
way far.
Well, and if that, and this, I think, gets to how important their beliefs about God were. Like, that, this is how they got through the day. This is how they got through being oppressed. This is what the history of an oppressed community looks like. It's like, oftentimes, how an oppressed community will get through the trials that are being inflicted upon them is they rely so heavily on their communal identity. And a lot of times that's wrapped up in God and what they feel like God is saying about them. And if you are being oppressed and somebody tells you like, hey, the thing that's getting you through this, that paradigm is off, you go like, you almost go, of course. And especially in a much less, in that day and age, of course that might be a natural reaction. Of course that would be.
Yeah, I think it's a great observation, and it helps me, like you said before, we read this kind of, and this is something you reference frequently, this idea of how do we give dignity to all parts of the story, that these were real people. Mm-hmm. And because if we don't, and I just want to step back from it, if we don't do that, all we're looking for is the moral of the story. Mm-hmm. And you cheapen, and it's not that the story didn't have a moral, but you miss that God is telling a bunch of stories here.
Yeah.
And it has a bunch of application here. And I think it's really important to recognize these weren't insane maniacs.
Yeah.
These were people that loved God by and large. It's just they felt, and man, this relates to so much of my church experience, they felt that we are connected with you up until the point you say this. Mm-hmm. And then it was so threatening to them that they were like, this has to end. This is blasphemy. Mm-hmm. And that justification was there.
And this gets into, like you mentioned before, about how a lot of people view like what Jesus came to do was to attack the religious leaders. And he does, in some ways, attack the religious leaders. But like when you have that paradigm of like, oh, what Jesus came to do was to fight for my group against the other group. That's just, it's switching your fundamentalism from, you know, one place to the next place. And, you know, that's not what Jesus is trying to do here. There's something deeply loving that Jesus is trying to communicate here. He's not trying to say, like, I don't believe his ultimate message is like, hey, all Syrians are all like, are better than all Jewish people. Right. He's using stories and language to try to I think he's trying to draw them out, because their identity is so entrenched, and their idea of what the Messiah is going to be is been so it has been so formed by their culture and by their country and by their history that we see it so much throughout the life of Jesus with the disciples, with Peter, even I think with, you can make a good case sorry, I don't know why I blanked there for a second, with Judas. It's because this is so deeply entrenched. And I think it's ultimately one thing that's so compelling to me about this, again, as we talk through these beginning moments of Jesus' ministry, because Jesus, for the most part, there will be these stories that pop up with non-Israelite people, but it's most of his ministry is around Israel and to the Israelite people, but yet from the very relative beginning, you can see these seeds of, no, this is for all people, for all time, to the ends of the earth.
Yeah, it is an interesting, weird line that happens, and I think about this a lot with his apostles. Like, how could they hold on to racism? You know, for all, I mean, Peter's being corrected years after Jesus dies on a cross about his racism, you know? And he believes that's alignment with God, is to be racist against the Gentiles. You know, they wouldn't have called it racism. They would call it, it's just the way it is.
The right
way.
We're the chosen people,
you know? And I think that it's fascinating that Jesus says in other places, you know, I'm going to draw all men to me, and you're making these judgments falsely. I think it is just a fascinating dynamic. I'm reminded, who is it? Is it Joshua? Man, I'm having a blank here, but they have the interaction where they're coming up on a battle. And, oh man, I hope you can remember where this is. But they're coming upon a battle, and whoever the leader is at that time, I'm vacillating between Joshua and Gideon, but I think it's Joshua. But anyway, he comes up to him, and there's a man of God there. I don't know if they articulate it as an angel or who it is, if it's Jesus there, you know, pre-being named Jesus. But anyway, and he goes, whose side are you on? He's like, I'm not on anybody's side. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that ain't the right answer, because there's the bad guys and the good guys. Yeah. And it's like, no, he. There's things he's going to do that's going to negatively affect one party in this case because they're acting in evil. But he's like, this is not me being your pet god. Yeah. I'm not beholden to you. You know what I mean? And I think that's true with Jesus. I think I love the idea of intimacy with God, but not that. I think it's just non-biblical to say God becomes your individual guardian angel, because that sets you up for, what if life doesn't go the way I want it, and whose life goes that way? Then, well, I don't even know if I love this God anymore. I can't be with the God who allowed this thing to happen to me. And I'm like, well, God's pretty consistent in allowing people he really loves to get really, might I submit to you this man, Jesus Christ? You know, it's just such a weird deal we make that God is, yes, if God is for you, who can be against you? That's, you know, Romans 8 there. But it is that dynamic. He is for you, but not in the way necessarily you expect.
Yeah,
and I think that's what's happening here is Jesus is for these people. He's not saying, I hate my hometown. He's not doing the graduation speech of like, I hate you and hope I never see you again. There's something, and that gets to my perplexion, but I want to hear what's on your mind.
Yeah, so what I'm wondering here is Jesus says some very harsh things to these people, and I think it's part of it is to get to knock them out of maybe some of the complacency or just, you know, the mindset they have about who the Messiah is and what God is doing here on earth. But I also wonder, like, this is very upsetting, but you also wonder, what was then the internal dialogue? You know, you go like, is this Joseph's son? Now he's saying this, and if he's saying this, then he must believe that and really want to say that. And so you just begin to like, because I'm a human and I've been that person before, you just go, you wonder how, like, Jesus says these things. And I think there's a way you can interpret them, and you can, you could probably hear them where like the person in the right mind could be like, oh man, I have assumed it's all about me. I have assumed it's all about us. I have assumed that I'm special and I'm, you know, set apart. And I go, you know, actually you're right. I do know my Bible. I do know the story of Elijah. I do know Elisha. I do know that this message keeps popping up. This thing keeps popping up. But yet that doesn't seem to be, that says the whole town. So that doesn't seem to be anybody's response. And you go, man, I think this is such a perfect example of how we listen to each other here and now. We tend to assume we hear somebody say something, and if it's something that goes against us or feel like it doesn't feel right for us, we tend to assume, oh, that must mean X, Y, and Z. That must mean he wants to take it further. That must mean he thinks I'm this or that or whatever it be. And in fact, it ultimately comes back to he is not a part of my tribe, and he's making my tribe unsafe. And so if somebody is making your group of people unsafe and is sticking out, then something has to be done about that person.
I think I find it amusing, not the culture, but this idea that it's new, that idea of cancel culture. It's like, oh, cancel culture, it's so bad. I'm like, yes, it is bad. And it's always been bad. Mm-hmm. It's just who's the one being canceled?
Yeah.
And who's the canceller? Because I think Christian culture has largely been a cancel culture.
Yeah.
I've seen people in churches say something, preachers or members, they say something that people didn't agree with. And it was not a loving response. I mean, they were asked to leave the church. They were fired from the job. They had to recant. I mean, even your story. I mean, that's cancel culture. And this is cancel culture Jesus is dealing with. You don't, you know, there is a right way to deal with disagreement. And this is not it. This is, we are shutting you up. I mean, they're wanting to kill him, you know, obviously. And so there's nothing more canceling than to say, we're going to kill you.
Well, and you think, like, is there in their mind, are they like, oh, so you're a Roman now? Like, that's almost what it would be like.
Exactly.
Whereas,
right.
like, if you were, like, to have a conversation about, I don't know, like, pick whatever big pet topic, like transgender issues. Mm-hmm. And because you were, like, not immediately on one side, oh, so that means you're a Democrat now. That means you're a Republican now.
Yes.
You go, oh, so you're a Roman now. And you hear that about Jesus, like, what an absurd thing to think. But the thing that Jesus comes to communicate is saying, hey, listen, it's not about your kingdom and it's not about the Roman Empire. It's about the kingdom of heaven coming here and now. It's a whole different thing than what you previously thought it was.
So that gets to what perplexes me is this idea of, I'm not suggesting Jesus did not believe it was going to go this way. He knew these people, you know. What would have been the positive outcome? Like what would have been the loving, if God is love and Jesus is God incarnate, so he's love incarnate, then what is the possibility that, again, we're doing that Doctor Strange, you know, 5 million possibilities.
Sure.
Here. What is the pathway that this would have gone well in Jesus' mind's eye? And again, he was ready for it not to go well, but I don't think he sets up situations so that people, he's not setting up a situation saying they have no choice but to react this way.
Mm-hmm.
There, what would be the positive choice? The thing he was saying, even when I know this could happen, I'm hoping it goes this way, you know, because that's part of, you know, love hopes all things, right? So it's like, what is the hope in here for him? You know, that's not the only thing that perplexes me, but that's the overriding thought.
Yeah, you do wonder. And so what jumped to my mind is wondering, like, is the outcome that he wanted what he ended up wanting from these people?
Right.
Like, did they need to have this? And, like, you know, did they need, like, and again, we don't get too much follow. You get some follow up with some of these people. But you go, like, did they need to bottom out? Did they need the, you know, this? Like,
that was the rock bottom.
Well, and again, you go, like, you hear stories. I've known people, like, I've known addicts who, like, you know, end up in the hospital, almost died. And, like, if they hadn't had that really last bad trip, then, like, they probably would have just slowly circled the drain. Mm-hmm. But it was because of that last, you know, horrific thing that they, you know, went through that caused them to, like, you know, cause them to rebound and heal in other ways. And you go, I believe that about people, both emotionally and in a spiritual life. Sometimes, like, we know, for Jesus, is he like, you know what? Pure anger is better than, like, this indifference of, like, oh, what a great speaker. And, oh, he's going to go do great things, this guy. What if he's like, no, like, it's better. Like, if you're, like, I'm saying these crazy things, it's better that you feel angry about my message than to feel ambivalent about my message. I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, I think it's a mistake to think Jesus has no intent.
Yeah.
I think it's a mistake to think he's like, hey, if you're not against me or you're not with me, you're against me, and let's go ahead and push that envelope. That's a little bit strong. I don't think it's a 100% guarantee.
Sure.
Let me put it that way. That's what he's thinking. I think there's a strong possibility. I think of two ways for it, but I don't know. One way is what you're suggesting is they needed a communal shame. They needed to recognize. They needed to wake up the next morning.
Like, did we try to kill Joseph's son?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we like him, and he was teaching so good. What happened to us? Because I know that happens to me. where I'll have this really strong reaction. I'll look back and I'm like, man, I'm really ashamed. And I don't think you should stay in shame. I think shame's a feeling that hits you, and maybe guilt's the better word because you're talking about your behavior. But I think shame would be applicable here because this was who they were. I mean, they were a people that had been taught for generations to be racist. I mean, there's no questioning that. And so I do think that need to be hit on. But the answer with God is not, ha-ha, you know, see how bad you are. The answer is, do you notice how much you need a savior? And so I think that's the other possibility, which, again, I don't think he was naive. But I think there's always a possibility to say, oh my goodness, you're right. Like, is there anybody in the crowd? You know, because is it hyperbole that every single person, like, is his mom? is James and Jude going, kill this guy?
You know? Well, and there are other examples where, like, in the Gospels, where they'll say something like "all," but then, like, it will clearly, like, it's just using hyperbole.
Exactly. So we assume his parents aren't here, or his mom isn't here, his brother's sister isn't there. You know, and clearly it gets to a point where his brothers do not believe, his mom is not believing, you know, at least fully. They think he's a little bit off the rails. Is that here? And what is Jesus doing that sets up that stage? You know, is there something in this piece that eventually affects them, you know? And the answer is, I don't know. That's why I say it's perplexing to me. But I'm guaranteeing you he isn't saying, the big thing I want to do here is show you can't kill me.
Yeah,
because I've actually taught this scripture, and that's what I've come away with is, well, Jesus is saying, you can't kill me. This is almost corollary to if you throw yourself from the top of the temple, you know, the angels will save you, show who you are. I don't think they're picking that up. And that to me is one of the most comedic scenes is it's like, kill this guy. And they get to the top and like, where's the guy? I mean, like, what's the next scene, you know, where they're all looking for him? I don't know. It's completely ridiculous. I just don't know how you don't hear more about this.
I absolutely want the morning after scene of who's the first person at, like, you know, as the town wakes up, who's the, like, are they just like quietly not talking about it? Are they, or like did Jesus' family, were they gone that day or whatever? And then they came back and they heard it, like, wow, that was not cool. But wait, what'd you guys do? It was like, oh, kind of like, we kind of like took him up to a hill, but like, you know, there was,
yeah, they play it off. They're like, we didn't really want to kill him. We just wanted to scare
him. Just rub him up a little bit. So it is so, because I would just love to know, just, I think it would be so helpful. Like, man, how should I deal with shame? How should I, you know, think about these things? One, it's just so helpful for me to be like, oh yeah, I can see myself fitting in into these people's shoes so well.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And don't think for a second you couldn't find yourself experiencing some offense that wouldn't get you into that crowd.
Oh yeah. Well, and if you were told you were told, and your parents were told, and your grandparents were told this truth, and then some guy, and to protect that truth, to guard that truth with everything, that God had given you that truth to guard with everything, and then some guy comes in and says, "Hey, you've got it wrong." Like, the only reason I have most of the perspective that I have is by the grace of God, and by the time, and when he, you know, when I've come about in my life, when I've lived my life, Jason and I are having a conversation, you know, about just life and what would have been different in family dynamics if some of our family members have been born 15 years later, and how drastically that would shift things. And so I think it's so helpful for me to always start off the conversation with going, okay, there's very real, there's a small percentage chance that I would have been the one person in the crowd being like, hey guys, I think he has some valid points.
Hold on.
Yeah. Listen, and I think today I like to think, like, if there was a murderous crowd that I would stand up for somebody, but like, if I'm being real, if there's a whole town, if Tulsa, Oklahoma is like, we got to murder this guy, like, I might text you and be like, this is kind of messed up. Like, do you think we can do anything?
Yeah.
Probably not. Let's go somewhere else.
That'd be my fear is I like to think I would be offended with everybody and be like, I don't know if this is right, but I get it. You know, I'd be in that group.
Well,
I'd be drinking coffee on the periphery, just kind of.
Yeah, you'd be like, man, somebody really needs to do something about this. But again, if you find yourself, okay, I'm one person in this massive crowd, like, do I die with this guy? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I got a family, and you know, like,
right.
And who knows? Maybe there was a person in that crowd who goes like, oh my gosh, they like totally got it for a second, and like their head was bowed, they're feeling the presence of God, and then they start to hear other people getting upset. Oh, okay. Nobody else heard that. And I feel like I've been in that situation where like somebody said something like in like a sermon or a message or whatever, and I go, oh my goodness, like God just spoke, and then afterwards I'm like, oh man, that dude just talked for way too long. It's too boring, you know, whatever. Be like, oh, We were not. I thought we were having this communal experience, and right. I had this big moment. That was not the case at all.
Just me. What about you? What perplexes you?
Yeah. So I think it is. Again, I talked about how amazing it is to me, how important this seems to be to Jesus, to be like, hey, listen, this is for everybody. The fact that you are going to assume that I'm coming, that the Messiah is coming, just for you, not for everybody else, that there is an other, that there is a outside group and that you're in the inside group. I think it's so amazing to me. But then I also just go, and this has always been, and I can understand, I've read plenty of theological reasons for why this is the case, but then I go, why did God allow these people to become so isolated? Because there are these things in the Old Testament that, like, and again, I think if you live them out truthfully in the way that God commanded them, I don't think you end up where they end up. But still, I go, yeah, I can see. If you had been told the things you've been told, if you had been, like I can see exactly how somebody would get to that perspective that the Israelites have at this time. And again, I think there are plenty of things like Jesus mentions here and plenty of other places where would combat that mentality. But then I go, yeah, of course I can 100% see how they get there. And I'm so thankful that this is something that Jesus wants to take a stand on or to communicate about a truth about his kingdom so early on. But then I just go like, but this is everybody. And again, I see, I'm like, okay, but this is myself. Like I do this exact same thing. And I have allowed myself to end up in these patterns. I don't know. Maybe it's a perplexion at just God not smiting us all instantly. I don't know what it is.
Right. And now you're to that big question about free will versus obedience. What does submission look like? You know, and which we can provide some answers to that without saying it's not crazy complicated. It is crazy complicated, oh, yeah. And it's very individual. How these, even this passage, I mean, I've read this passage hundreds of times easily, taught it so many times, and yet for the first time I'm like, oh yeah, I see this piece. So I say all that to say, if you brought forward the Jason of 1998 and the Jason of 2007 and the Jason of, you know, 2014, I would be in disagreement with those three people too, mm-hmm. You know, and just recognizing how unique it is, our journey with God. And yet, you know, every dogmatic Christian you've ever experienced, there was a piece of them that they thought they were obeying God. Yeah. I'm not saying they're right. I'm not saying they were reflecting the fullness of God. I'm simply saying there was a piece of them that thought they were, you know, when Judas was doing what he was doing, I'll bet you there was a piece of him that thought he was obeying God.
I do too.
You know, and I think the same with when Peter, you know, this vacillation of Peter where he's like, you will never be killed, to, I don't know this guy. You know what I mean? There was a piece of him, and call it, there's survival there, there's protection there. But Peter, at the time of denial, doesn't know Jesus is going to be, you know, resurrected, of course. And he's got to think about the future. You know, he's got to think about life with God beyond this guy who he thought was the Messiah. But certainly the Messiah wouldn't die on a cross. Mm-hmm. So he was going to be struggling with those same doubts. And my point in all this is we have to be super careful to condemn other people and say, well, how dare they do this? He was the Son of God. And it's like, be really aware that is a position of condescension that I don't think any of us can sit in.
Man, that is so good. And I think the thing that I want to sit with is there are moments right here where Jesus directly confronts this problem of racism, of tribalism. And he directly confronts it and wants it to shift and change. But there are also times where, you know, Jesus lived with these people for 30 years. You know, he lived with them right. for 30 years before this happened. And you just go, man, okay, what does that mean for me today? And it doesn't mean I need to not call out injustice or not speak to it. But you go, I think, again, in terms of vacillating between, you know, passive and aggressive, we tend to have this assumption it's got to always be aggressive. Like, you know, you see one thing. It's, you know, why was Jesus talking to me? You know, that's something we're not going to go down this pathway because we're almost done here. But like, is this an issue where like Jesus had been talking to people about this sort of thing before? And like, not this thing with Jesus again. Like, we had this meeting with him before. We told him to not talk about this again. And now that he's speaking with all his power and whatever. Or when somebody said something like, you know, like, yeah, it's us and everybody else. It's us, you know, versus the Gentiles, and we're the good people and we're the people that God favors. And when Jesus heard those things, you know, like, what did he do? What did he say? How did he react? I don't know.
Yeah, I'll tell you that idea is because we're up against our time, but it is that, I mean, this whole thing. Okay, let's imagine choose your own adventure style of what else could have Jesus done based on what we see in other places, you know? I mean, in the Bible, you know, obviously he had access to the power to strike them all blind because Elisha did that. Obviously he had the power to cause a bear. We'll stay with just Elisha. Bears to come out and kill them all, you know? It's like they're not even commenting on how long Jesus' hair is or if he's bald, you know, but he could have done whatever he wants. And that's the fascinating thing to me about this point. Jesus was assertive at the very least, depending on his tone of voice, maybe aggressive with these words that were very offensive. And he doesn't punish them for attempting to kill him. Mm-hmm. That's weird, you know?
Yeah.
At least in some kind of, shouldn't he have sat there and let their, you know, so he fades to the crowd. And it's like when Paul gets stoned and then he's taken outside to get stoned and then he walks back into the city. You're like, don't go back into the city, you know? But it's like he leaves, and it'll be interesting to track how many times he interacts from people from his hometown after this, and what's the residual energy there, and just so much messiness. And yet God is saying in this passage, for now, this is what you need. And so I will say, thank you, God. And I will continue to pray about what do you do about this truth.
Thank you for listening. Grace, peace, and love.